Welcome to Season 4, Episode 3. In this episode, I'm going to cover 5 brain-body systems that I call gatekeepers to help us get better at accessing our ability to heal and find a source of strength and resilience and adaptability for overcoming life's stressors and challenges, and for promoting a sense of well-being within our relationships, as well as just within ourselves, within our communities, and even in our career trajectories. These are 5 systems that I have had a decent amount of direct work in. I will be pulling from various research studies that I will list in the episode webpage. But a lot of this is coming from my own experience working with physiological markers in live time with people during transformational journeys, such as intensive retreats where we go deep into their past, their negative and self-limiting programming, as well as their family of origin, trauma, things like that, as well as work in neuropsychology clinics where we took extensive measurements pre and post-treatment, as well as during treatment, and a massive number of psychometric testing that has all been research-supported. And having an experience where I would get to see changes in some of these physiological markers and some of the brain-body systems that I'm going to talk about in this episode. This also comes from my earlier research at NYU, where I worked in a lab and hooked people up to electrodes on their face and skin conductance sensors on their skin, heart rate measurements, and brain imaging. I've also used all of these types of gatekeepers or brain-body systems in my own life, and I will share some ideas that I will be borrowing from my own experiences in what has helped me gain a much deeper sense of well-being and purpose and thriving in my own life. So thanks for joining me. The first of these 5 systems is the brain, and there is a caveat, an asterisk that I like to put with this, which is that although I like to talk about various networks and systems of the brain and how they all function and help us optimize our lives, the tricky thing with the brain that many of you have heard me mention before is that it's not possible in lifetime for anybody to know which networks of the brain are underactivating, overactivating, which systems are rigidly connected and which ones are more flexibly connected, etc. There's no way for us to know this. And so I will be sharing some ideas about the brain, but this is an area where we can do our best to apply what we learn about the brain in our own life. But the real only true way to know if we are making progress is if we feel better, if our relationships are functioning at levels that we desire, if we are making choices and decisions that align with our values and our highest potential. And all of these are generally constellations made up of micro movements, micro decisions, micro shifts in all of the different systems that I'm going to mention in this episode. So that really is a big piece that I want to leave you with, is no matter what we talk about in terms of science and physiology and all of these things, the only thing that truly matters is your actual lived experience. and what you are noticing about yourself and how you are taking steps to not only make new kinds of decisions that feel better, but to also notice your own progress and your own evolution. And that is something that I do see a fair amount in the coaching and transformation work that I've been a part of for almost 2 decades, is that people can have a very hard time noticing their progress. So it can be helpful sometimes to have some kind of measurement that gives them a clue that they are making more progress than they maybe are currently aware of. So we can do that with our own selves by just trying to take an inventory of things we've learned and more wisdom that we may have that we don't realize we are actually accessing thanks to the trials and challenges we've been through and the lessons we've learned. But we can also take an inventory through some of these gatekeepers that I'm talking about today. In terms of the brain, there are various ways we can look at how it is the system that brings us to a higher sense of well-being and flourishing. Part of this has to do with how the networks are communicating. And some of the ways that we can look at this are in terms of brainwaves. So brainwaves is something that I have quite a bit of experience with. And it's basically a way that pulses from masses of neurons are communicating with each other. So as systems and networks in the brain are communicating, they're sending pulses to one another. And depending on where these networks are located and how well they communicate, the speed at which those pulses are passing along those networks can be measured by putting electrodes onto the head, and we can get a sense of how fast some of these oscillations are occurring. Brainwaves are often described in bands, so you've likely heard of the delta, theta, alpha, beta, and possibly high beta and gamma bands. And these are useful just to help us describe a general function of those wavelengths and those speeds and frequencies that those networks are communicating with each other. But another way to look at it is that these bands, these frequencies, are more of a continuous spectrum of consciousness. So they go from very slow and loud and functional to fast, subtle, and complex. And the frequency of these brainwaves is a reflection of our level of consciousness and awareness of the external world in many ways. So brainwaves are a little bit like musical notes as well. I think that sometimes is a useful analogy. And the lower frequencies, for example, the delta range, involves a very high number of neurons. So it's more of a functional brainwave. It underlies many very basic physiological functions of what we do, of our life. And it's very loud and has almost like a tribal drum beat type of rhythm to it. It's loud, deep, and penetrating kind of frequency. That frequency, the delta, has a lot to do with many of you have heard it come up a lot when we talk about sleep. There is a lower level of, or almost non-existent, level of consciousness of the external world when delta is a very dominant brainwave. So all of these brainwaves are occurring really at all times. It's just that depending on what we are doing and thinking and feeling at a certain moment, some of these frequencies will rise up in activity and rise up in their volume, in their amplitude of what we can notice because of what we are doing and thinking and feeling. And that's activating different networks, which is creating speeds, different speeds and frequencies that are happening. From there, we see theta, which is also a slower brainwave. So delta is usually considered to be in the 0 to 3 hertz range. Theta is generally from the 3 to 8 hertz range, meaning that there are 3 cycles, waves per second, up to 8 waves per second in this frequency band. Theta has more to do with a bit of drowsiness. It's often what you can see right before sleep as people are drifting off. So it's a letting go of the external world in a sense. And there can be a lot of metaphor, dreamlike, trance-like, even hypnagogic also types of states that we might enter into, which can also be a place of some of the unconscious things that have happened, unconscious kind of repressed type of memories and experiences we have. And even there's some theories about it being related to creativity because it's where we let go of all the details of the external world and we go more into a metaphorical kind of space. Alpha is the 8 to 12 hertz range. And this is often known to be related to meditative states. So we have seen in monks who have done a lot of meditation that they tend to have a higher amount of alpha, especially in their frontal regions. And it's very symmetrical across those frontal regions. So alpha is a relaxed awareness. It is the being present, being in the here and now. And it is something that helps with overall mental coordination and alertness and mind-body integration with learning. The beta waves are from 12 to 38 hertz, and they can be divided into different categories. So they are a more of a faster kind of activity. And these are most dominant when we are in a waking state of consciousness. And when our attention is more towards cognitive tasks and the outside world. These also come up when we are engaged in problem solving, trying to figure things out, decision making, judgment, and other kinds of focused mental activity. So in the low beta range, that's the 12 to 15 hertz. This can be kind of a musing type of state. The beta is 15 to 22, generally speaking, and is more about really actively figuring something out. And then high beta is a very highly complex thought, but can also be associated with high arousal, high anxiety, also excitement, and can also be seen as the urgent type of brainwave where there's a very high external focus on detail and a very fast pace, in a sense, to the thinking. Gamma brainwaves are, according to current research, the highest that we understand at this point. And so that's from 38 to 42. And this tends to be related to a simultaneous or synchronous processing of information from various brain areas, even far-flung networks of the brain, all synchronously and simultaneously connecting and processing. So it is often looked at as it has been coined as a hyper-learning type of state where we have aha moments and insights. And it's also comes up a lot in spiritual type of meditation kind of studies and a expanded consciousness where we're going beyond the realm of our usual type of consciousness. What's really just important to know about this is that we can have an overabundance or lack of some of these frequencies at times where it would actually be useful to have them. So for example, when we close our eyes, alpha instantly, for the most part, and significantly increases. We've removed external stimulus, visual stimulus, and so the brain is now reading inputs that are more from an internal environment. And generally speaking, alpha increases as we close our eyes. What's interesting is if a person has a difficulty or a smaller ratio of waves that happen when they are alert, open their eyes, and then they close their eyes, this can be an indication that they're having a very hard time relaxing. I have also seen this in people who've had trauma, where when they close their eyes, they actually get very activated. So something to know is that the better we get at figuring out ways to get into a relaxed state is going to be something very helpful for our brain, where if we can be in a place of problem solving, figuring things out, and then learn how to shift into a quieter state, a relaxed state, this is a very good indication that we have this ability to activate our brain in ways that are very flexible and adaptive. If we are in a kind of revved up state from problem solving, thinking all day, and then as we attempt to relax, it feels like our mind is still racing and at a very high speed or still calculating, that's going to make it hard for our entire body and all of our other systems to slow down and get the restoration and rest that they need. So any kind of practice where you are intentionally relaxing, intentionally doing something to get your brain into a slower rhythm where you feel yourself restoring and regenerating, this is a very good thing to do for your brain. And then on the flip side, if you are always in a very slow, relaxed state, so if that's the case for you, then engaging in real intentional kind of problem solving and creativity and doing things where you're maybe collaborating with others or you're creating something for yourself, you're inventing or designing or innovating, doing something like that is also important that you're able to shift up into those. My practice for training my brainwaves to enter into states that I want to be in is meditation. So that's my number one recommendation for everyone everywhere is meditation of some sort. Another way to say this is an intentional practice of honing our attentional mechanisms. So this can take the form of focusing on something that has a rhythm to it and a repetition and consistency to it. That can be your breath. It can be a sound. There are plenty of sounds you can use on different apps, meditation apps. I like Relax Melodies, which is now called Sleep Better, I think. You can also have a mantra from any kind of text that makes you feel happy and inspired and relaxed. You can have that going on also in your mind. Michael Singer, who's one of my favorite meditation teachers, talks about the word Om, which many people have heard of from Buddhist traditions, that having this sound of Om repeating in your mind can be useful. You can have it where you have an open monitoring kind of awareness, where you're just paying attention to different sensations that are happening. You just pay attention to your thoughts. My suggestion for beginners, if you're beginning meditating, you're beginning some kind of practice, is to have something that you can anchor onto as something that you know you're going to focus back onto, whether it's your breath, a mantra, a sound, because that's what lets you know your mind has wandered. And every time you bring it back, the bringing back your attention to that anchor is what strengthens those attentional mechanisms. And the rhythm of this is what helps induce more of an alpha state. There is a rhythm to it. And you're still conscious. You're relaxed, but you're conscious of your experience. And that's more of that alpha state. So it's a really beautiful brainwave to have and intentionally hone as best we can. And it's something that can help us transition into the lower states for going into sleep, but also keeps us in a state of consciousness where we can also go back up into beta. So this is why a meditation practice is so helpful, because it's not quite a sleep where it can be harder to get the energy to come back up again and to become alert and awake for your other activities. You stay in that zone where you're hovering and you're still conscious, but you're very relaxed. So I do recommend a meditation practice of some sort to help you hone these states, these speeds, if you will, and how your brain activates. The other thing that comes up with brainwaves that I've seen a lot is the, in a sense, the rigidity of how networks communicate. When we see something called hypercoherence, it means that some networks are just overly talking to each other in an almost rigid fashion. Hypocoherence is where we see not very efficient processing, networks not communicating in very efficient ways. What can help with all of these is any type of learning and opening ourselves up to new experiences where we are a bit of a beginner and we have to engage lots of different new circuits in order to advance our skill, our understanding, our ease of whatever that is. So any form of learning and new experience can be really helpful for getting some of these networks to talk to each other in more efficient ways. It helps open up activity where if we have a lot of rigidity, then having new experiences and new types of learning get other networks to get involved. And that energy flowing to those newer networks helps to soften the rigidity of the very hyper-coherent ones. And on the other hand, when there's hypocoherence, means it's not very efficient communicating, learning does the same thing. It also helps us to get those networks to talk in a more efficient and proficient way. So learning and any kind of even memory, cognitive kind of exercises where we're working on remembering and shuffling digits around, those can be helpful. But honestly, any kind of learning, and I would also encourage really getting the body involved. So embodied learning experiences where it's something new, something we do need to focus on as we try to learn a new skill, but our body is involved in this because that also activates many other cortices, other areas of the brain when we involve the body because other senses are coming in, sensory motor networks are getting involved in new ways. And remember too that learning doesn't have to look like you're taking a course. Learning can be definitely a hobby, a skill, a sport, but also communication skills, relationship skills, leadership, public speaking, learning about family dynamics, post-traumatic stress and healing. All of those are forms of learning. They're activating new networks in our brain for us to integrate and increase communication among many different networks. The other aspect I see with brainwaves is hemispheric communication. So looking at the right and left brain and how they're communicating together. One thing that we see in some research is that, for example, not being able to describe our internal and emotional experiences can have some connection to asymmetry in the brain networks, in the hemispheres. So being able to nuance and describe our feelings is one way that we are increasing right brain, which has a little bit more to do with self-regulation and our kinesthetic sensory motor experiences, and then connecting it to a bit more of the left hemisphere that has some more of the symbolic kind of networks that have to do with the words. This is really helpful for emotion regulation. This is also something to think about if we are with children, we work with children, that they still have a lot of developing they need to do in terms of the cortex, not just their prefrontal cortex that you've heard me talk about, that has to do with executive functioning and their ability to inhibit behaviors and impulses and coordinate communication across networks. But the cortex in general is still developing, still creating connections between the cortex and other systems of the brain. So the more we also describe our feelings in physical, kind of tangible ways to kids, that can be very helpful for them to learn how to nuance their experiences, which can be really helpful for them to regulate their experiences. So that means instead of only talking about emotions as these labels already, like angry, sad, that's already a level out, a level beyond some of the communication that's happening in their brain at that point. What can be more concrete and easier for them to get in touch with are things like my brow is really scrunched, or I feel prickles in my fingers, or my chest is hot, or I feel tightness. And then describing what's happening in that moment, the context with that. It can help all of us get more in touch with what we're feeling without already putting a label to what we think that emotion is. And the last part of the brain that I want to mention is the prefrontal areas, the frontal areas. I've talked about this in many other episodes, but this, the frontal areas, the prefrontal region in particular, has a lot of associations with what's called executive functioning. And that has to do with inhibitory control, as well as adaptability and flexible problem solving. And it's the control tower for the rest of our brain. So some ways that we can get better at integrating what we're doing and enhancing the activity of the prefrontal region is, for example, self-reflection. So any kind of monitoring of our own activity and reflecting on it is something that activates networks, particularly the medial prefrontal cortex, also known as the witness or observer, to get more involved. And that helps just get blood flow to that region of the brain. That can then help with coordination and even inhibitory types of signaling for the rest of the systems that are in the brain. And inhibitory function, inhibitory control is a really, really, really big part of mental health, resilience, and well-being. And that is because the ability to inhibit certain signals allows for other signals to rise up and have a chance. So it's part of what actually gives us more flexibility because we can suppress one thing and that allows us to adapt and switch and choose from other responses. So any kind of self-reflection is something that can be really helpful. And anything that you're doing where you're being very intentional about your thoughts, about your words, your experience, journaling is one way we can do this. Meditation, like I mentioned before, and anything where we're becoming just more intentional and conscious of what we are doing in a given moment. That's where mindfulness comes in. When we wash the dishes, we really pay attention to that moment and what the sensations, what the stimulus are of washing the dishes, for example. These are things that we can do in tiny micro moments throughout the day. It's something that I learned in the monasteries where I trained with monks for several months at a time. They had little notes on the light switch and near the toothbrush, on the mirror, on the kitchen sink. And there was just a little reminder of being mindful in that moment. So come back to what you're doing in that moment. Pay attention to it. Do it intentionally with a high level of consciousness. And that's something that can also activate these really beautiful rhythms and activity in the brain that help us then transfer that into other areas of life. The stronger those networks get in our quiet moments where we're being intentional, the better access we may have during stressful moments as well. So that's something to think about. So that's an overview of what we can think about in terms of the brain and its role in our healing and resilience and thriving. The next few sections will be a little shorter for each one, but I'm going to talk now about the heart and specifically heart rate variability. Heart rate variability It has to do with the variability that occurs between the peaks of our heartbeats. When it comes to our heart rate and what's happening in terms of our breathing, there are two systems that are giving inputs at all times, and that's the sympathetic and the parasympathetic. And I'm sure many of you have heard of both of these systems. The sympathetic has more to do with an aroused state, so it's more of the immobilization system that has to do with fight or flight. And parasympathetic, para means stop. Parasympathetic is the what you would call the rest and digest. There's a slowing down of our systems. Our heart is getting messages from both of those systems all the time. When we have a high heart rate variability, this is generally a sign of well-being and resilience and an ability to recover. And what it means is that your body is being responsive to both sets of inputs from the parasympathetic and the sympathetic. So it's a sign that our nervous system is more balanced and capable of adapting to its environment. The reason why we have this variability is that we do want the ability to mobilize quickly and engage in that sympathetic mode when needed, and then also to very quickly and adaptively slow down when needed. A lot of this has to do with the fact that we are social creatures as well, that if we are constantly in a sympathetic mode, our system is going to be giving off signals that we are not safe, that we are not present, we're not safe to approach in a certain moment. In order to have social connection and relationships, we need to go into more of a parasympathetic mode, a socially engaged mode, where there's a slowing down, we're not ready to fight or run away. We are there to stay in that moment with a person. A slight combo of that is when we're in play and sports. And that's a combination of we still have some sympathetic activity because we're very active and mobilized, but we're really engaging our facial muscles, our voice, our eyes, our eye gaze in order to stay socially connected to a person. So we're kind of having both systems play with each other in a sense during those moments. One way to help increase your heart rate variability is to engage in slow-paced breathing. So slow-paced breathing is generally associated with higher heart rate variability. And it's when you are especially slowing down your exhale. That's a key part of it. You can also introduce a pause at the top of your inhale and then let it out. And you have a long, slow, quiet exhale. Quieting the exhale can be really helpful as well. And you can introduce a small pause at the end of that exhale. There's lots of different teachings on breathing techniques, so you can check all those out. I have used HeartMath. I think HeartMath is great. I have some mixed feelings about it, but I do think it's a great introduction to just learning about heart rate variability and different ways that we can intentionally slow down our breathing and increase our HRV, heart rate variability. Any kind of activity where we maybe purposely get our system to be more active, so through movement, and then having a relaxation and quieting down practice immediately after, and really trying to see how quickly we can recover our breath. That's a great way also to increase your heart rate variability. It's helping you use both systems and train your nervous system to respond to your cues of slowing down. And part of that's going to come from your mind. So you're going to need to use your mind, your mental force, your mental systems to purposely slow down your exhale and potentially also think of things that help you relax as well, which might be stretching and you really feel your body in those stretches. Those are some examples. So finding ways to have activity that increases your heart rate is great. And then being able to recover and relax. These are different things that can help with heart rate variability. The next system I'll mention is the face. And particularly the facial muscles, but also very much the eyes. So the face is something that is a really big indicator of our internal state. When we are in pain, depressed, distracted, these are states that can be reflected in very flat facial expression. So not a lot of engagement of any of the facial muscles. When we are stressed, agitated, or anxious, this can be shown in tension in the jaw, for example. And when we are disgusted or displeased, that can also be indicated in slight little movements of muscles around the nose. When we're feeling safe, engaged, attuned, and present and relaxed, we may see a little bit more softening of the forehead muscles and also around the eyes. And in particular, when we are enjoying and appreciating something or someone, there is a very natural kind of activation of muscles around the eyes that research has shown that are only activated when we have this enjoyment. It's called the Duchenne smile. And it was discovered by a French anatomist named Duchenne, who found that when people were forced to smile, those muscles did not engage. Only when they were very organically and naturally enjoying something, those eye muscles activated. So they are immediately a cue for someone else that you are safe to approach, that you are attuned and enjoying the moment. But again, it's not something you can force. It's something that you have to become present to within your own body. Know that all these little muscles that are activating are visual cues for another person, whether they know it or not, are registering inside of their body as to whether you are someone they want to approach or avoid. So know that the more intentional you are about your internal state, the more this is going to be reflected in these tiny little micro movements of facial muscles that are visual cues for another person to understand what your state is. One other aspect I'll bring up in terms of the face is also the eyes, the actual eye gaze. Our eyeballs are controlled by muscles, and the way those muscles shift are another visual cue, first of all, to another person. So when we have mutual eye gaze, when our eyes lock onto another person, this can create actually a kind of an arousal type of state, an excitatory state. This is something we see in a lot of research between caregivers and infants, that when the caregiver and infant have mutual eye gaze, it arouses the nervous system of the infant. So it puts them more of an excitatory type of state. It also is associated with oxytocin and even endogenous opioids. So it's generally a feel-good type of arousal. However, there is something called intrusive kind of caregiving. And what this relates to is the fact that when, especially children, when we are young, we don't have the capacity to completely regulate our own nervous system. We have to interact with our caregivers, particularly in our environment, in order to do that. So in these moments where there's this eye gaze, it can release these neurochemicals that can create an aroused kind of excitatory state. The way that a child, an infant, regulates their nervous system is when it starts to feel overexcited to the point where it's not sure it can even regulate and calm down, it will avert gaze. They will move their eyes away in order to relax their system again, to go back into parasympathetic so that they can regulate. If a caregiver in those moments tries to keep eliciting eye gaze or eliciting a more of an aroused kind of play or exciting kind of state, this can actually overactivate that system in the child. And there can be even longer term effects of anxiety and even somewhat avoidant type of attachment styles because of this intrusive nature where they were not able to find a sense of regulation with their caregiver. And this is because of a key word called attunement. So this relates to our lives as well now as adults, whoever we're interacting with. Attunement means that we pick up on the signals and we are responsive and adaptive and flexible in every moment. So we might be making eye contact, but if the other person is averting their gaze, that is not a moment to keep forcing eye contact, for example. That is a misattunement. So attunement means that we are reading some of these facial muscles and eye movement, for example, and we're creating somewhat of a dance. We're trying to figure out how to continue connection and safety and engagement in those moments by tuning into those signals that another person is giving and possibly using other methods to create a sense of safety. So, for example, if the eyes are being averted, another way we can introduce a sense of safety is through our voice and using a very specific kind of frequency to let the person know that you're still there and engaged, but are sensing that they're maybe not comfortable with eye contact, as one example. But the other, just to come back to eye contact, it is extremely important for us to have in certain moments. It's something that does help us release oxytocin and feel a sense of connection. And it's important that it's very, very present. So tiny little shifts of eye movement are going to let another person know that you might be distracted by your own thoughts. So your eyeballs actually move depending on what you're thinking and focusing on. So if you're distracted by your own thought, you're thinking about something else, your eyes are going to give that away to another person. They're going to sense you are not present and you're not attuned to them in that moment. Where our eyes are looking and how fast they're flitting about is also something that activates our brain in different ways. So this is another key area of life where we can really start to be more intentional, is what are you doing with your eyes? When you go outside, having an ability to look up and around is really helpful for your brain. It helps activate different kinds of activity that is very different than, for example, when we're looking at our phone. When we're looking at our phone, it's a very tiny space. It's a very small dimensions. And that means that our eyes are only traversing tiny little areas. As it's doing that, it's flitting very quickly from one thing to the next, one thing to the next. That flitting about, that very fast movement, is going to activate tinier clusters, in a sense, networks in our brain that can relate to higher, faster type of brainwave activity. So know that also, for example, if you want to relax, having your eyes move very quickly and flitting about from one thing to the next is not going to be a great way to do that. And that is why using your phone to relax is not really accurate. You might feel kind of engaged by the phone and there's a sense of zoning out that can happen, but it's not going to truly relax those brainwaves. You need to be potentially removing visual stimulus or looking at visual stimulus that's slower and very rhythmic. And that can be like looking at water, going outside, looking at the leaves, the wind blowing through the trees, things like that. Nature is another great way to use our eyes in different ways. Looking at large spaces between things, very large objects, things that are far away as well. These are things that activate our eye muscles in different ways and help, which translates into different kinds of brainwave activity. Think about your eyes and how intentionally you're using them. Try to slow down your gaze, let it land on things more often, and take a break from screens because they're so magnetic because of the light that's coming in and the movement that's generally there. We need to be able to have our eyes look at other things in order to activate brain networks that fire in different ways. Be intentional about your eyes, where they're looking, even the eye muscles, your facial muscles. These are all really important things that you can monitor in yourself in terms of what you notice as what helps you relax, what helps you feel connected with others, feel present. And this is also just another subject of discussion for another podcast, but it is why I think very important for young people to have some contact with people in their lives who will be fully tuned in, attuned to them, where they can have a bit of this mutual eye gaze at moments and safe facial types of expressions. I think that that often can be missing in a lot of the groups that I've seen of young people because they're very used to being on their phones. And so there is actually a lack of this eye contact and these facial expressions that are happening. So know that also with, in terms of your facial expression and eye gaze, that being distracted by your own thoughts or by a device will translate into cues to another person that you are not fully attuned and present. And that's not going to create a sense of psychological safety for them. So just some things to consider about our facial gestures, our facial muscles, and our eyes. The next gatekeeper or brain-body system is the voice. And the voice is something that I think is so unbelievably powerful in terms of how we connect to others and how we regulate our own state. So by being very intentional with your own voice, allowing it to feel rich and smooth and aligned with your current state, and your intentions is a really great way for you to regulate your own system as well as have that effect on others. So you're going to have different intentions behind what you want to achieve in each moment. And I like to look at different categories of this. I think one of them is comfort. If you are wanting to comfort and connect with somebody, your voice is going to have a certain frequency to it if you are aligned with that state inside of you. Another is more of a creative type of state where you want to boost inspiration and motivation, and that might have a different kind of frequency to it. And that will also be based on your internal state. It might be a bit more playful, a bit more energized. And then on the other hand, there's a control kind of intention we might have. This can be used adaptively or maladaptively. But this is where we do want to persuade someone in a certain moment. And that could be a child where we need them to adapt their behavior in a certain moment, or where we are leading a discussion or teaching and we want a sense of authority. Our voice frequencies will also take on different wavelengths in terms of that internal state. That internal state and intention that we have adjusts how the muscles inside our pharynx and larynx and other areas of the vocal system, how those tighten and relax, and how we are breathing in a certain moment. And all of that changes into very specific features of the voice that are detected by others as different intentions and internal states of us. I go really into depth in this in my book, by the way, if you want more research on that. So think about how intentionally you are using your voice at different times of the day, at different interactions, and know that you can use your voice to regulate your own state and to help regulate the state of others or to align with a different kind of intention you have at different moments. So you can do stuff on your own with singing as well, singing and humming, but also with getting very clear about what your intention is within an interaction, and then allowing yourself to be more intentional with how you speak, how quickly you are speaking, how smoothly you're speaking, if you are letting there be pauses in response, how you're breathing in that moment. These are all things that can allow us to have more intention and mastery over our voice as a tool for transmitting our intention and our desired state and our desires with whatever interactions we are having. And then lastly is our body and limbs. And I'm going to mainly just talk about hands in this one, but just some things to notice are what's called agitation or retardation in terms of psychomotor types of activity. There is a decent amount of research on some mental health challenges like depression, where one of the biggest indicators can be a much slower movement that is noticeable to others. It can also look like slower or lack of facial expressiveness that I've mentioned before, and slower speech, slower kind of how someone walks, a slumped over type of posture. These are all indications that we are kind of lacking in energy to get up into a more energized state. On the other hand, anxiety can be indicated as more of an agitation. So a lot more restlessness, tapping, fidgeting, pacing, hand wringing, very fast, rapid talking, moving objects, things like that. These are ways that we are using our limb, and they're indications in many ways of what state we're in. So that sympathetic state is going to have a lot more movement to it within our limbs. And the parasympathetic state is going to have a slower movement. If it's slower to a degree that is not helping us with life to an unhealthy degree, that means we're in more of a hypo-aroused kind of state. So it's parasympathetic, but to a degree where we're not being flexible about it, we're not being adaptive. It means that we are unable to engage our higher activity kinds of systems. In order to have balance in all of this, it's important to engage in all kinds, a giant spectrum of movement and how we are using our limbs. And hands is the one that I like to focus on a lot. Our hands and what we are doing with our hands are beautiful indicators of where we're at. And when we are intentionally using our hands, we are creating really powerful circuitry of getting that brain involved where we are monitoring ourselves. It also means that we are engaging more inhibitory kind of control because we are using our brain in order to send signals through the motor system to slow down or hold on, let go, doing things with our hands. It's a really powerful thing to think about and add to our life in terms of how intentional we are. I like to look at it again as, are we using our hands to consume, to comfort, create, or control? So consuming can look like we're grabbing for that thing to ingest. We're grabbing for an external stimulus in order to regulate our internal state. That can also include a device or anything where we are taking something, putting it in our hand, and we're using that to alleviate our distress or to energize us in some way. When we do that, if we're not doing that in intentional ways, that means it's more of a reflex and possibly even somewhat of an addiction where we are unconsciously grasping for things to comfort us. We have the ability in our mind and internally to do this. So if we're constantly grasping for things outside of us to do this, we're doing something called shifting the burden to the intervener. I go into that in season 2 of this podcast. But shifting the burden to the intervener means that as a self-regulating system, which we are as adults, so remember, infants are excluded from this. They're not self-regulating. They do tend to need to have something that they use to help regulate their system as they build up their self-regulatory systems. As adults, our frontal regions are much more well-developed, so we have the capacity to regulate our system to become self-regulators. And we can do that by many of the things I've mentioned throughout this episode, which is focusing our thoughts in a new way, slowing down our movements, slowing down our breath. All of those are things that we can do to self-regulate. We can also intentionally engage in activities like movement, going outside, singing, music, any of those things. Those are all ways that we are being intentional about self-regulating. But again, with the caveat that we are aware that we have the ability simply by using things that we already have access to, such as our breath and our mind and how we are focusing it, how we're using our attentional beam of awareness to focus on thoughts like gratitude or calming down, things that are pleasing to us, mantras, etc. Using those internal devices is the highest way that we can engage in self-regulation. When we very unconsciously and automatically are grasping for things outside of us, that means that we are shifting the burden of self-regulation to something external. And the problem with that is as soon as you don't have that external thing, you have robbed the mechanisms, you have atrophied the mechanisms inside of you to help you regulate your own nervous system. So the more you can do to build up those internal mechanisms, the better. And one way is to monitor what you're doing with your hands. You don't even have to completely eliminate grabbing the object, but having a moment of awareness that you are grabbing an object in order to regulate your system, change your state in some way. And then if you can, either delay or really slow down that grasping of whatever that object is, that can be a great way to introduce this more self-regulating kind of brain activity where we're inhibiting and monitoring ourselves to a certain degree. And lastly, with our hands, another interesting thing to know is that grip strength is a really highly researched indicator of cognitive health, mental health, particularly in older adults, but across the lifespan. So grip strength is just really important for us to have. And even in studies of almost 500,000 people in the UK, they looked at the association of major depression and lower cognition and also in anxiety, and lower grip strength was associated with all of those things. So use your hands in intentional ways. Use them to create and to build strength in whatever ways you can. All of these things are ways that we can enhance our brain, body, and nervous system functioning. So that was a giant overview of various brain-body systems that we can use more intentionally. And throughout the episode, I shared a bit of what has worked for me. I'll add also that a very big thing in addition to meditation is two other key things. One is a gratitude practice. So that has been something I turn to again and again throughout life, where I engage in a journaling practice of writing 10 things that I'm grateful for and why in a journal. And I do it every evening. And in the morning, I either use a journal or I count on my fingers so that I am keeping track and I'm staying conscious. And with my fingers, I count up to 10 things that I'm very happy about, appreciate, am grateful for. I think this is a really powerful way to use our mind because we are often in a seeking type of mode and problem solving, searching for the next problem to solve. And although that's an important part of how we evolve and adapt, we also need to have times where we are noticing what's good, noticing what is there. And noticing is a very big part of mental health and resilience. So people who are incredibly good at innovating and creativity happen to also be the noticers, the people who notice things other people don't notice. Using your brain to notice things is also really helpful. And I find that using a gratitude practice is one way that I activate my brain in that way, where I start to notice things in my environment, in my life, in my loved ones that I maybe hadn't thought of before. Going into a place where we are noticing things that are good induces a sense of psychological safety, because in that moment, as we are activating those brain networks, there's nothing to solve. There's nothing to be vigilant about. Doesn't mean that those senses go away. Those are always there to help us. But in that moment, when you're under the covers or you are on the couch, those are moments where instead of using your mind to calculate things and not take any action, which is actually a very misaligned way of using our brain, we can use our mind to notice what's good, notice what's here that we like and we appreciate, and then use intentional time later for doing brainstorming and calculating and problem solving. But again, this all comes down to intentionality. When we are using our mind in intentional ways, means that we are able to induce a state and brainwave activity that is helpful to us in those moments that we want to have. The other practice I have is what I call my library of truth. And I have books around me that have brought me comfort and inspiration and creativity and love, and I have those nearby so that even just looking at them often creates just an association of things I remember from the book, or I will open them up. And I have a few spiritual ones, but also very nerdy science ones. So I have, for example, Michael Singer, Living Untethered, An Untethered Soul. The Little Prince is one of my favorites. Donella Meadows, Thinking in Systems. The Conscious Brain. I have books on the second law of thermodynamics. And Eckhart Tolle as well. And a few others, Alan Shore. So these are all examples for me of books that I like to have around me. And I think it's helpful for us to know that having words that are from people who put a lot of intention into creating a book. And that's what's so beautiful to me about books is so much intention goes into them and a very strong purpose in a sense that when we surround ourselves with those words and let those words enter our mind, they activate networks as well and give us access, more access to be able to activate similar kinds of thoughts and ideas for ourselves. So those are all different ways that we can use various brain-body systems to regulate ourselves and access more intentional and desired states. So thanks for joining me for that episode. I hope you enjoyed it. As always, you can email me at hello@stephaniefay.com if you have ideas for guests or topics that you'd like me to cover. And I am so excited about the NeuroCoach program that I've launched. I have connected with extraordinary people and we are having incredible sessions together where we are really going into the depths of their clients and what their brains and faces and voices and bodies are doing and how much people are so beautifully impacting others' lives and doing it in very intuitive ways, in a sense, that it's really special to see how they light up when they hear how much science is behind what they do. It's an incredible feeling for me. I love giving that sense of inspiration and confidence for people who are really doing incredible things in terms of how they are contributing to others' lives and helping other people. So I have some educational consultants, thought leaders, and some graduates who are going to be offering brain mapping as well, which is the other service that I'm offering through this program. The list is pretty much full now, the roster just for this spring, but I will have another round in early summer. So if you are interested, you can email me at hello@stephaniefay.com or visit my website, stephaniefay.com/neuroscience, and you can click the button there and learn more about it. It's really an honor, and I really hope to keep building this community. We have triannual meetings where we go over case studies together and really building a network of thought leaders and helpers who are really trying to make life better for a lot of people and optimize human functioning. I hope you get a chance to check that out or share that with someone who you think would be a good fit for that. So thank you for joining me for this episode, and I will catch you in the next one.